Welcome to the 10K Collective podcast. Listen, if you want hacks, my friend, I'm afraid you're in the wrong place. Our philosophy has grown out of the 10K Collective London Masterminds. Members, by the way, make between $500,000 and $7 million a year in e-commerce, mostly on Amazon. Many have doubled revenue in the last 12 to 18 months. If you're that kind of person, this podcast is made for you. We're not puritanical. We use hacks. We just don't think you should focus on them if you're building a real business. Instead, we focus on what's been proven to work in the group. Real brand building, clear strategic objectives, courageous long-term goals, and long-range thinking. If you like that focus, keep listening, and welcome to the 10K Collective. Ladles and jelly spoons, boys and girls, welcome to the 10K Collective podcast, the place to be for six, seven and eight figure Amazon sellers. But also, I like to think these days we bring more to the table than just for Amazon sellers. And that's quite deliberate because as Amazon develops and gets more competitive and as the people selling on Amazon become by necessity more sophisticated entrepreneurs, the broader e-commerce picture or even the broader online marketing context, once again, I think is becoming very relevant. So we've got a fantastic guest who can both speak to selling and buying Amazon FBA businesses, but also put that into context, which I think is very important. So we get outside the Amazon bubble a bit. So that person is Mark Doust from Quiet Light Brokerage. Mark basically helps online entrepreneurs to plan and execute successful exits. And that includes a lot of e-commerce and specifically Amazon as well. So a fantastic person to bring to the show. And Mark, warm welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Michael. Super happy to be here.
Yeah, great to see you. And a fellow lover of this giant, as you can see, if you're watching the screen, the video version of this giant, lovely road podcaster thing, which is made in Australia of all places. That's very unusual in e-commerce. So completely random fact there. So
I had no idea.
So, Mark, first of all, tell us who you work with. What sort of entrepreneurs do you work with when they're planning to successfully sell their businesses?
Sure. So we work with all sorts of online entrepreneurs. We have a lot of bootstrappers that fall under our umbrella and end up becoming part of our family here at Quiet Light Brokerage. But we work with Amazon sellers, private labelers, FBA, and also e-commerce, general e-commerce business owners as well. Most of our clients have an established business that's been around for at least a few years, you know, 2-3 years or more. I'm actually representing a business right now, if you can believe this, not e-commerce, but it's 25 years old, which is in internet years, ancient. I mean, we're talking about launching the same year as Yahoo, if you can imagine that. But for the most part, we're dealing with bootstrappers and the people who have been building up their e-commerce businesses and are looking to exit those businesses or maybe make that next churn and cash out on some of the work that they put into the business over the past several years.
And I know you got some statistics that you shared with me before the show of the sort of transactions that you're doing and the kinds of businesses. Would you mind just sharing those with us?
Yeah, sure. So last year we did about $75 million in closed transactions on behalf of our clients. So that's the total enterprise value of businesses that we sold. We're expecting this year to actually do far more than that. I would say a very conservative estimate will be 100 million, but I wouldn't be surprised if we break 125 million for enterprise value based off what we have in our pipeline. Of that, about 80%, a little bit more than 80% was based on e-commerce. And out of that e-commerce, over half of those companies, around 55% of those companies were either entirely based on Amazon or partially based on Amazon, had Amazon as one of their sales channels. And just for your reference, the way that we classify this, you know, there's a lot of Amazon sellers who also have a website, but when you look at the revenue mix, it's 90-10, you know, Amazon to website. We would consider that to be an Amazon-only business for all intents and purposes. What we're really looking at with this kind of mixed platform would be if it's 50-50 or more biased towards the website, which is becoming increasingly rare. So Amazon is a huge portion of what we do, and largely because that's where a lot of our growth in the online entrepreneur communities is coming from.
There's no surprise to me that it was very interesting to hear the stats, but that reflects exactly the percentage of the, well, not exactly the percentage, in fact, you're more biased towards e-commerce businesses than I suppose maybe the percentage of businesses out there. What am I trying to say? What I'm saying is your mix represents the dominance of Amazon pretty accurately, I guess. And it's also interesting to hear that what you say means mixed platform, i.e. it's sold as basically not just being an Amazon business. It has to be about 50-50 split, which is very interesting to hear. So we'll have to think about that. That's an interesting question, the mixed versus pure Amazon, you know, how you classify it. The first thing to do is just give us a little bit about your background, and then we'll plunge into some questions like, why bother even selling your Amazon business? And is my business sellable? Which I think are probably the two big questions that are on most the top of most people's minds when I speak to them. So tell us a bit about how you came to be buying and selling businesses, obviously working a very big, big level.
Yeah, I mean, it's a long time ago now. I guess it's amazing. I woke up one day and I realized I've been doing this online stuff for quite a while, going on 20 years. I believe it was now 15 years ago. Yeah, 15 years ago, I had a content website, and I was newly married at the time, so pretty young and going about you know, building that up. And I thought it would be interesting and fun and a nice feather in my cap to sell that. So I hired an advisor to help me sell it, and was uniquely unimpressed with the process. And like so many entrepreneurs, I looked at what he was doing and looked at it and said, well, he gets 10% of what I'm getting. So I built this business. He gets 10% of it. How great is that? And then my second question was, how hard could it really be? Which is always a dangerous question to ask as an entrepreneur, because we all know it puts you down a rabbit hole of, this is actually a little bit harder than it looks on the surface. It looks simple at first, then you get into it and you think, okay, this is complex.
Yeah, that sounds like an Amazon business as well, by the way.
Yeah, exactly. I can just order some products from China and sell them on Amazon. That sounds great. Not to mention all the supply chain headaches and tariffs and everything else that you might have to deal with. So it was one of these events in life that sort of presented itself. I sold my business. And I took a year where I was kind of working in some new ventures that were fledgling. I mean, they really weren't doing that well. And a very good friend of mine who I had known from a previous business decided to sell his company. And he knew that I was tossing around this idea of working as an advisor, as a broker. And so he asked me if I would help him sell his business. And I did. We really had no business selling it. And looking back, you know, I look at what I did and I was like, okay, there was a little bit of luck involved there, as often is the case with a new startup. But we got the business sold. And early on, you know, that first year, we used that and launched Quiet Light Brokerage with that. In that first year, the first 2 years is really honing in on the process, taking a look at the M&A industry and understanding the complexities and what they were doing to really make their transactions safe and secure for everybody. And then going a little bit deeper and trying to find out within this online space, what are buyers looking for and how can we really prepare a business and help a business owner really, really well? One of the things that was near and dear to my heart during this period of time is when I had sold my business a few years prior, I felt very much like I was roped into a long exclusive contract with a lot of big promises. And when it came time to actually doing the work, I didn't really think that the advisor was doing a lot of work. And this is unfortunately a reality of this industry, right? Most of us are paid based on performance. And so you end up getting this approach that a lot of people take, which is the value is in the number of contracts that you can sign, and a certain percentage of these are going to sell. So you just kind of take, you know, spaghetti, throw it at the wall, see what sticks, and that's what, you know, you're going to take home. And I felt very much during that process that there wasn't an aligned interest. So with Quiet Light Brokers, I really wanted to change that narrative and find out a way that we could help business owners in a real way, give them realistic valuations, help them really understand what is my business worth, what's driving that value. Because when you know what your business is worth and you understand what's driving its value, your decision making becomes that much more clean. You know, when I sold my business, I was told a number. I was told a number. I think they quoted me like $350,000 for the value of the business. The first offer I received was $75,000. It was an absolute punch in the gut because I've done all this work, and then I find that the first offer is just absolute junk. And I'm thinking, what have I done? And I actually had pulled my listing from the marketplace when another buyer popped up and the broker reached out to me and we ended up selling it, but for far less than the $350 that I was quoted. And so I'm getting long-winded now and I apologize, but you talked about the background and the origins. A lot of the background and the origins of starting Quiet Life Brokerage was trying to be a real advisor that could help an entrepreneur understand what is the value of the asset that I'm holding so that they can make that really crucial decision of should I sell or should I hang on to it? Because that is a very crucial decision and you really only get that opportunity once with a business. So ironically, with the business I sold it twice, but that's another story. really trying to help people understand those dynamics so that you can make good informed decisions.
Okay. Well, thank you. I mean, that background, I'm always wary because as an interviewer, it always feels like an incredibly lazy question. And in a sense, it is. But on the other hand, I think for a lot of people, and you're absolutely a classic case in point, that you are experienced as a consumer of a service, in this case, an owner of a business that serves consumers, presumably, or somebody at the other end, but actually you were consuming, if you like, the service of brokerage and a business brokerage. And that you experienced a rather broken service and you aim to make it better, which is, by the way, one of the best possible reasons for creating a product or service. And I think people artificially distinguish two things, which Werner Harnisch from Scaling Up, for example, who I respect as a great business thinker, says, like, let's just get this out of the way. Business to business, business to consumer, services, products, let's stop making artificial distinctions. So I think if you find a problem that you're experiencing as a user, consumer, client, whatever you want to call it, again, artificial distinctions, and you spot the need for improvement and you can deliver that improvement, then you have created something from the ground up based on a genuine consumer need. You know the pain of it because you've experienced it yourself and you can understand your consumer's mindset. And I think the same is true for physical products. And I would just warn anybody against the idea of just following a bunch of numbers in order to choose a product. You should do something you care about. Anyway, plea over, but thank you very much for the background. Very interesting. So clearly you're aiming to be a real advisor, and that's great because you're on a podcast. That's a perfect place to give people free advice. So the first question then that strikes me is, sounds like a dumb question, but I always like to ask the dumb questions because they're often the ones that are actually in people's minds, is why bother selling a business? If you have a business that's sellable, and we'll talk about what makes a business sellable in a sec, why would you even bother to sell it? Why not just hang on to it?
I think it's a great question. And frankly, it's the central question of what we do. So my answer might surprise you a little bit. And I would suggest that you shouldn't aim to sell your business, first and foremost. If you can run a business, it's generating cash flow and it's good for you. It doesn't take a lot of time to run and you're happy with it. Hang on to it. What people need to understand with an online business is that A, they're harder to start than you might think. When I sold my first business, I turned around and thought, oh, that was easy. I could do this again. And when I tried to do it again, it was a little bit harder than I had anticipated. And I didn't realize just how much a little bit of luck, a little bit of fortune, a little bit of good timing all play together to make this mix that turned into something valuable, right? So my first advice would be this. My first bit of advisement would be this. Having a business that you own that's generating cash flow gives you value in two places. One, the most obvious is the cash flow itself, right? It's generating income. Two is the value of the asset itself. And that's growing. And that's something within your total net worth and your total portfolio of net worth. That's valuable. If we think about this in terms of stocks, you can think about it as the cash flow that's being generated is akin to a dividend. And the value of the business is akin to the price of the stock itself. So having a business is a great thing from a financial standpoint to have within your overall portfolio. Now, there does come a point in time when selling does make sense. And fortunately, that exists. Otherwise, I wouldn't have a job and I wouldn't have an income doing what I do. So when is the right time to sell a business? And what I would, and why would somebody even look at this? Well, one, I would argue, and the numbers play out to this, especially for physical products business that's growing, most of the actual cash value that you get from your business is going to come from the moment that you sell that business. For a lot of business owners, that's the cash out period, right? The actual dynamics and cash flow dynamics of running an e-commerce business that's growing, an Amazon business or e-commerce, or even a SaaS business that's growing, is there's a lot of reinvesting of the profits into inventory or into other elements, which are building up the overall value of the asset. but it doesn't represent a larger bank balance for you. And when you sell that and cash out of the asset, that's when you get paid the cash portion, which can be a very good event. But I would argue that the time to consider selling happens more when there is a landscape shift in your life, a change of direction that you want to take. And that might be starting a new business. That might be pursuing another business or acquiring another business, or maybe scaling up bigger. Maybe when you realize that you've taken a business that you've started to a point where you aren't really interested. And I'll share a story on that real quick. I was working with a client. This was probably about 5 years ago. He had acquired a business a few years prior for, let's say, $35,000, $40,000. It was a very small acquisition. And he had grown this to a business that was doing around $400,000 to $500,000 in profits annually. It was about $2 million in revenue annually. And he wanted to sell the business, even though he was continuing to grow it. And I asked him why. You know, why wouldn't you just continue to build this business? He said, you know, Mark, right now I keep all the inventory in my second garage. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, my son and I go out there and we slap labels on the boxes and we ship them out. And it's a really great life. If we're going to grow this, we need to get an office, we need to get a warehouse, and I need to hire people. And I am just not interested in doing that. That is a great time to look at exiting that company, right? Because he had no desire to grow this into a huge operation. He was very happy with where it's at. Other moments that might be very good would be, again, changes in your life. You have a marriage coming up and you want to take a year off for a honeymoon. You have a child coming. I sold a business actually from the UK just last year where the founder of the company was having his first baby and he wanted to spend that first year really kind of soaking up that moment of his life. Beautiful reason to be able to sell the business. Other times can just be a little bit more banal and boring, but I would argue that selling just for the money alone probably isn't the right reason. You should have some other motivating factors to sell. From a financial standpoint, though, this is your cash out moment. So getting the timing right can be really crucial if you do want to maximize that value.
Thank you. Really, really interesting answer. I mean, first of all, what an honest answer for a broker to say, like, honestly, you shouldn't be aiming to sell a business in if it's working for you. And actually, that makes sense. But what strikes me very strongly about what you've just been saying about selling a business is that a lot of the time, particularly the Amazon opportunity, but then other things historically, like, you know, creating niche sites for Google, particularly back before, I don't know, whatever, Penguin Panda, whatever animal updates come next, you know, and Tim Ferriss in the 4-Hour Workweek was all about Google traffic, pretty cheap AdWords back in the day to niche sites, whatever it is, the pitch is normally the same, which is it's lifestyle based. And it's about being able to do things like you were saying, spending time with family or loved ones and having a lifestyle where the way you run the business is actually quite pleasurable. And it's so interesting that actually what you're saying is that and that ties in with what I see with other people, many of whom are Amazon business owners, obviously, or former owners, many of whom have sold their businesses and done things like put an extension on their house, developed a sort of different sort of software-based offering, taken just some time off because they've been working, building businesses in some cases for years. And actually the promise that is often pegged on top of build an Amazon business and get this lifestyle, I think is kind of true, but that actually isn't true the way it's put, as you said quite rightly, and I see this as well. This is a tough reality check for a lot of people that the most of the money you make needs to be reinvested. So you get the lifestyle when you sell the asset, and the asset value finances the lifestyle rather than the cash flow from the business. I mean, that's really chimes in so strongly with what I actually see and what I try and gently put across to people and educate them. I don't think there's much more to say about that in terms of the selling thing, but I just wanted to articulate that. I mean, does that chime in with what your clients come to you? Does that seem like a reality for them as well?
I would say so, but I do think that there is a point where you do turn a corner. And unfortunately, that number is pretty high. We do start to see the cash flow situation improve pretty dramatically when your EBITDA and your revenue is, well, let's say revenue is about $10 million and $1 million in EBITDA. And those numbers, those ranges, maybe $1.5 or $2 million in EBITDA. Then the cash flow starts to become real where you can actually live off that cash flow pretty comfortably. But before then, yeah, it's a lot of reinvesting the profits into the business. And I think why, you know, I quoted the numbers as to how many Amazon businesses are being sold compared to other businesses in our mix. frankly, I would like to have more of the other businesses as well, just from a stability standpoint on our side, it would be great to have that. But I think this is one of the main drivers, right? Running an Amazon business is cash intensive, and it's also logistically intensive as well. I think there's a lot of snags that people run into, and what we deal with a lot of sellers is they're just sort of done with it. They're done with trying to estimate their inventory 3 months or 4 months ahead of time, and then running into Chinese New Year and realizing that they're going to miss their window. It's a very common sort of issue. So I get it. I do get it. I get why people are selling in this space. And I do think, you know, as you said, it is a good opportunity. And I do think you need to look at it as that, right? If you don't have visions of growing to a 10, 15, 20 million revenue business, and understand what comes with that size of a business and the logistics that come with that, and just think that's not for me, well, then exiting at some point probably is a good idea, because you will get that cash out of the business, out of the asset value. But my argument overall has always been, building a business is hard. If you find something that's successful, then my intent is keep it, because it's hard. It's really hard to build that. Sell once it makes sense, because you don't get a second crack at that.
Yeah, I think that's a very good check as well on you know, the counterbalance to selling is that people often say, well, I'm going to sell my Amazon business and then go back into the Amazon game. And as you said, first of all, the game will have changed quite violently sometimes in some sectors from when you first went in. If you started a business in 2014 or 15, which is when I first started doing stuff, and selling on Amazon, it was such a different game. The barriers to entry were lower, you know, that you could get away with murder, which you would get your accounts permanently suspended now, and things like that. And then also there's the degree of luck. I mean, I've experienced that outside of Amazon with podcasts. I started a podcast 4 or 5 years ago. I thought, well, that's not too hard. And then starting recently, of course, the average downloads are way lower per podcast, because there are just a lot more people in the platform now. So same thing across the board, right? Generally speaking, if you're into something on an upward trend, if you go for long enough, then a lot of competition comes in. So you're wise to flag that up as well as a counterbalance. So thank you for the honesty about that. So, okay, so let's assume that then somebody is considering the idea of business sale. The next question is, okay, is my business even sellable? So tell us about that.
Yeah, sure. So Amazon businesses are generally quite sellable, but there are some things that you want to look at to identify if the business is sellable. Let's first talk about the age of the business. Typically, you know, the older the business, the better, as a general rule. I would say if you're younger than 12 months, if your business is younger than 12 months, definitely wait. It would be a very rare situation where we would even take that on as a listing. Buyers are going to be very skeptical of that, right? A lot of businesses see a quick burst only to die off shortly thereafter. And so buyers typically want to see that sort of sustainability. And let me just back up real quick and let's put things, I'd like to frame these conversations of, is your business sellable and how much is my business worth and all these sort of general questions, and try and reframe it and put yourself in the mindset of somebody who is going to invest and acquire the business, somebody who's going to pay you, you know, multiples of what you earn on an annual basis and profits for the business. Why are they doing that? Well, they want to get a return on that investment, right? No one's going to spend $1 million and hope that they lose that $1 million the next year. They want to make that $1 million back, and they want to earn more on that for the long term and hopefully grow the business significantly. So sustainability is a very big portion of that. Your history helps with the sustainability and make that argument. So if you have a five-year-old Amazon business, that shows some good stability and some good sustainability. If you have an 8, 9, 10-year-old Amazon business, wow, that's really sustainable. You've survived a lot. As you pointed out, Michael, the game has changed significantly and you've rolled with those changes and you've succeeded. So I would argue age is number one. Second of all, revenue and earnings is number two, right? This is pretty important. If you have a very small fledgling little business, could you sell it? Yes. Is it going to be all that valuable? No. You know, and these are all relative sayings, of course. You know, is it valuable for when I talk about that? You know, you still might be looking at a five-figure exit, but in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't compare with, say, a business that's doing $1 million of profits per year. So we do look at that revenue. We do look at the earnings, and we want to look at it on a couple of levels. One, from that buyer perspective first. If you're generating profits, that represents return on investment for that buyer. But there's also a market adaptability aspect here, right? If you have a business that is churning $10 million a year in revenue, that means you have a product or a set of products that are in high demand. And that's a good thing, right? So now we can build on that, and that becomes appealing for a buyer. Outside of those two questions, that's going to apply to frankly, any business, right? Is it old enough and do you have market adoption for your business? And does that market adoption show in revenue and earnings for the business? Outside of that, within Amazon specifically, the number one problem for Amazon is the ubiquitousness of the marketplace. The fact that if you are selling blue widgets, there's nothing stopping somebody else from selling the same blue widgets, right? And so the differentiating factors really become price and your ratings, which is, you know, so easy to manipulate on both ends that we do look for other aspects. And there tends to be a hierarchy within Amazon accounts that we look at. So the more intellectual property protections you have, trademarks, brand registry 2.0 at this point, patents or even provisional patents, this helps your business pretty significantly because that provides some protection against that competition. Any sort of uniqueness to your product, if you're private labeling a product, have you created enough variants on it to make it unique? These are the things that we look at in the business. Conversely, on the very other, on the far end, and Amazon has largely killed these types of businesses off, but if you are a dropshipper on Amazon, ordering from somebody else, and there's really no restriction to anyone else selling, these businesses really aren't that valuable on Amazon from that sustainability standpoint. We know it's a matter of time. I'll give you an example of a company that we saw that really got bit by this. They were selling a product that would go in a home bar, right? So you have people over at your house and you want to mix up some drinks. This was the type of bar where there was really nothing distinct except for the fact that this product was probably a little bit higher quality than anything else out there, but it wasn't really distinct. And initially, the seller had found a niche market and found a lot of people ordering the product. And so you took a look at the revenue and it was skyrocketing. I mean, we were talking triple digit percentage gains year over year. It was remarkable. And then it created enough volume to be picked up by all of the intelligence tools that are out there, and the market got flooded with cheap knockoffs. So, you know, same type of product, a little bit lower quality than what was out there. So they were able to lower the price. Consumers really weren't discerning that much about the quality of it because, you know, option A was just about as good as option B, and I'd rather save $5, right? And so what we saw was the revenues on this business absolutely take a slaughtering on it, and it became a very difficult sale for that particular business. So what we look at is how defensible is your product in a wide open marketplace, right? Where your only distinction, again, is are your ratings and then the uniqueness, maybe intellectual property that you have on the business. So in my world, I love any sort of business that is super defensible on Amazon with intellectual property. The only other variant that we say on this would be contracts with existing brands where you are the exclusive seller of a brand that's well-recognized. That can be really valuable depending on the contracts that you have. So that's a wide, wide perspective. I gave you a lot of information there. So I'll throw it back to you if you want to try and narrow down and stop me from my wild rambling wanderings of explanation on
no,
this
No, that's great. I mean, when someone's an expert as you in an area, which is I have not bought or sold businesses and certainly not worked as a broker, I think it's great to have straight from the horse's mouth. So what strikes me above all this stuff is basically, apart from, I guess, stability and defensibility are, I suppose, the things you're talking about, and then also market adoption. Do people actually want what you're selling? And it's interesting that you see revenue and earnings almost more as proof of market adoption than just the value in and of themselves, which is an interesting way to look at it. So from in a sense, a non-financial perspective, because I think what happens with a lot of Amazon sellers or digital entrepreneurs generally, they're good at blending creativity and business kind of scrappiness with analytics. And that's a great strength. One that becomes, I think, a great weakness is when we mistake the numbers for an end in themselves. They are just a proxy for value, right? Because in the end, if you really want to get into the psychology of this, if I'm going to buy something, it's often because it's going to change how I feel ultimately. If I feel something is sustainable, defensible, those are sort of product, those are sorts of words I would use if I was selling insurance, life insurance, I don't know, a Volvo car that's very, you know, safe. So it sounds like a weird thing to say, but I think in the end, what you're saying to me is the same stuff that I think you would want. If you're selling a lot of things that are less numbers driven, which is the feeling of sustainability, defensibility, and stability. And I would argue ultimately, those are psychological values, which is interesting because they show up in numbers. But I think if we just obsess with numbers, we can miss the point. Just a thought there.
What are your takes on that?
Yeah, so I would agree 100%. I think sometimes our clients, especially when they have their first conversations with us, get a little frustrated because we immediately jump to the numbers, right? And we ask them about the revenues. We ask them if they're growing or if they're shrinking. And we take a look at what their profit margins are. We take a look at what their gross profit margins are. And it feels very clinical, you know? And a lot of people look at it and say, well, what about the great product design? Like, look at what I did. You know, I created this thing out of bamboo, right? That, no one has done this out of bamboo before, you know? And so people get a little frustrated at that. But the point that they might be missing is that financials, and this is an evolution on my part as an entrepreneur and business owner, personally, your financials are much more than just the raw numbers of the business. They are actually a thousand checkpoints of health for the business that tell a lot about the characteristics of what you've built. And by looking at an income statement, by looking at a balance sheet, we can learn a lot about the marketability of the business. We can learn a lot about the expansion opportunities with this business. We can learn a lot about can this thing survive a price war, right? If you have 80% gross profit margins, wow, you've got some nice ammo set up for a price war if that day ever comes. Conversely, if you've got 15% gross profit margins, you better really be careful and be a really good operator and strong with logistics. There are so many qualitative factors that come out of these numbers. And I don't want to drone on. I have a tendency to drone on about the numbers. It's an area I'm passionate about, mainly because so many people lose value in this area of their business. And it's so easily controllable. But this market adoption, again, put your mind in the seat of a buyer. They're looking to buy your business and acquire it, but not just sit on it. They want it to grow, right? So I sold a business last year that was growing like mad. I mean, this thing was just crushing it. And so we talk about what is the defensibility? Well, they had provisional patents. They had trademarks. They had a website that collected email addresses. And so when they launched a new product, they were able to immediately rush people to that new product. And they were able to show with every new product that they launched, it was a home run. You know, if it wasn't a home run, it was a double, right? To bring in a baseball analogy here for you. They had this track record and a lot of assets outside of Amazon that they could leverage to be able to show not only are our existing products absolute successes, but we have this huge wide marketplace of product launches that we can do for the next 5 years. And from a buyer's perspective, that's just mouthwatering because it's so appealing to know that there's a system in place, there's a set of raving fans that are going to buy this new product, and there's an infinite number of variants on this product. That's kind of the mix that I look at and say, yes, you have a super sellable business. You don't need to be at all those levels. I don't want somebody to think, oh man, I don't have any of that, or I only have one of those items. You'd be surprised at what can be sold. But if you want to look at what is the most sellable business in the Amazon world, that would be the mix that I look for.
So to sort of to try and clarify a point that you brought up, I think clients you have, i.e. business owners, or entrepreneurs, i.e. business builders, which is a different thing from just owning, right? They have that attachment to elements of the business, which is not probably highly relevant to the buyer, because the buyer is buying, they're not buying a physical product. And you may get brilliant at creating physical products and very attached to them, and you probably should and will. But nevertheless, if you look, you need to look at, instead, it's like not seeing the forest for the trees. You can say, look, this tree is very beautiful. I've nurtured it from being a sapling to this lovely big tree now. But the point is, you're selling the forest, and they need to know about, okay, what's the value of the land under the forest, and you know, so forth and so forth. So in other words, however, you are selling a product, but you have to just kind of see your entire business as a product, right? And I believe that that's probably the shift in mentality. And I guess for me, my understanding of how this stuff works is that the numbers are the thing that the buyer wants to see. But the reason they want to see the numbers is to end up with another, if you like, qualitative experience, which is like the potential for expansion, the feeling of safety and sustainability, the feeling of defensibility, right? So in the end, although it is via a very intellectual, like clinical looking medium, i.e. spreadsheets and such things, I would imagine that really the buyers will be looking for, in the end, psychologically driven things, but they just might express it in a different way. They might say, I want, you know, certain percentage EBITDA or whatever. But what they're probably saying is, I want this thing to be defensible so that if this market tanks, we can still survive, right? Is that a fair summary? I mean, is this the right mentality that we should think of with the buyers?
Absolutely. And I would argue maybe to the chagrin of your listeners that buyers tend to have a little bit more objective look at your business than you do. Entrepreneurs and business owners, we tend to bias towards the things that the problems that we've solved, even though those problems and the solutions may not be the main drivers of the business. So I would argue that the buyers tend to be a little bit more objective. Also, I'll throw my hat in the ring as an outside advisor. I'm going to be a little bit more objective than you in your business as well. And so you'll come to me and you'll tell me about all the nice wrinkles that you put into the business, which is great. I want to hear that. And the buyer wants to hear that because they want to know how you view the business. You're in it on a day-to-day basis, but we do see this all the time. Business owners tend to discount the risk that is actually out there with their business pretty heavily because they grow comfortable with it over time, right? You've run the business for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 years, and that risk has never realized itself. And so you kind of forget it. I liken it to the guy who's playing Russian roulette and he comes and says, so it's perfectly safe because I've never shot myself, right?
Yes.
But from a buyer's perspective, you're looking at that saying, yeah, but there's still one bullet in the, out of six. And that's a little bit more objective of a way of looking at it. As entrepreneurs, we do bias ourselves towards the business a little bit, and that's fine. You want to know about that. But do we want to take a look at, is your business sellable? Let's take this a little bit more clinical approach, but to the point of what you were saying, and I think you put it beautifully, the numbers really do turn around to a qualitative aspect of the business, and where we are looking at, you know, oh, I'd like an 80% gross profit margin. Well, it's not the 80% that I like. What I like is I like the ability to have this nice cushion in the case somebody attacks me from a price war, or wow, you grew 100% year over year. Well, it's not really the 100% year over year that I like. It's the fact that I'm going to, I know that even if this business starts to decline, I'm still seeing growth. That's the qualitative aspect that I really like.
Yeah. And to your point as well, what strikes me about this entire conversation is even if you never sold your business at all, making it more defensible. And again, talking about psychological drivers, in the end, as entrepreneurs, we've got to sleep at night and we've got to have conversations with our wives, husbands, or whoever is involved in our lives, never mind other shareholders or employees as well, and be able to say, okay, is this job going to be here for you next year? Is our house going to be here if we've got a loan secured against the property, which frankly, for really big loans, often is still the case. Even if you theoretically your business could get a loan against it, it's often the director who secures the loan, right, in practice. So things like having a cushion against all the things we've said actually would be desirable aspects to have in your own business. In fact, the other thing you just flagged up, which I think is very important, is to, whilst not scaring yourself, to be real about how big the risk is you're running and how, what, you know, the risk reward ratio, and to have a plan to say, well, for example, you know, a certain percentage of your earnings might be taken off the Amazon table and put it into property or some more stable asset or class or whatever it may be. But the point being that this objective look that you look at, the lens you look at from the outside, I think can only serve to make it a better business, even if you own it for the rest of your life. And I know there are a couple of guys in our mastermind, one of whom's had the family been business beginning for four generations. One of them's just literally celebrated over two centuries of existence that they aren't going to be probably selling. That's going to be going to the grandchildren. But in that case, I really want a defensible business, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think in a way, the more I talk with business brokers, the more I realize it's just a really healthy process to go through. I mean, that's, you know, there's no way around that. You know, objective is healthy in when it comes to business.
If I could make a pitch to your audience, to your listeners, I've already made my case that I believe holding on to a business for the long term is your best option financially. So I want that to be the baseline here. But I'm going to make another pitch to the audience, and that is develop an exit plan. That doesn't mean you have to follow the exit plan. But my reasons for saying this are twofold. One, you don't know what the future holds. I can tell you the number of times, the number of valuation requests that we receive from people or expressions of interest in potentially selling, where a business owner woke up one day and I already said, you sell when the landscape of your life changes, right? When something comes up. The number of times that somebody wakes up and that landscape changed and now they're thinking, I'm going to sell. And they aren't ready, it's a very high percentage. My business partner preaches over and over again. He says, don't decide to sell, plan to sell, right? That doesn't mean that you have to actually go down that path of doing this. So one is just being prepared, but two, and maybe more importantly, and to the point that you were bringing up, Michael, and I think this is a fantastic point to make and one that I've been trying to make for the past several years. putting in place an exit strategy and building your business up in its asset value and its potential saleability benefits you as the owner, because no one is going to pay you a substantial amount of money for a business that isn't desirable to own, right? They will pay you a lot of money for your business because it's great to own. And if it's great to own for them, it's going to be great to own for you. And going through this exit planning process, it has a number of virtues that just naturally spring up. And one of them is risk awareness and understanding where the risk is in my business. I'll tell you a very quick story on this. I was in the process of selling a business several years ago now, and we were at the very end of this process. We were 7 days out from closing. 7 days out from closing, we're often calling vendors and letting them know, hey, we need to set up an account for this buyer. By the way, I'm selling the business. They're going to be a great owner of the business. Well, this particular business had one primary vendor that they were using. We always preach, have multiple vendors if you can, at least backup vendors that you have in the event something happens. Well, my seller called up his vendor and said, I have somebody who's taking over the business. They're going to be great to work with. They have lots of plans to grow it. And the vendor came back and said, I've been meaning to call you, decided against offering to web-based businesses altogether. You have 48 hours to remove all the product from your website and our logos off the website. And poof, right? All of a sudden, the value of this business is completely in question. However, he had gone through this practice of setting up alternative vendors, even though he wasn't using them, because he went through this exit strategy planning process and understood with one vendor, that's perceived risk. Let me at least have a backup. He was able to go out to that backup vendor, replace the product. We ended up delaying the closing by about a month or so, and we were able to get the business closed. It ended up working out really well for the buyer as well. This wouldn't have happened if he didn't go through this exit strategy planning process and understood that a single point of failure with vendors was a problem, right? All right, so I've gone a little bit deeper into this than I wanted, but I wanted to say again, from an exit strategy planning process, what you learn are the real risks to your business, and you also understand where the growth opportunities are with the business, and it also helps you put your documentation in place, which you should be doing anyway. And I've never met a business owner who goes through this process of documenting their business and says that was a waste of time. It is always a valuable thing, but we typically don't do it unless we need to. All right. Preach absolutely. Over. I'm done.
No, but I so agree with you. I mean, I really think in the end, it's not a sexy word that anyone likes, but the word discipline springs to mind, and objective. Those are not characteristics that are natural to most entrepreneurs that I've met. And I certainly include myself, if I even dare use the label entrepreneur for myself. I mean, I think it's widely banded around. I guess to some degree I am. I'm running a little business and, you know, surviving and scrappily trying to grow it and enjoying the process. So I guess I qualify. But the point is, the nature of the beast is normally such that I've sat, for example, in Amazon Masterminds where one of the members literally had a nosebleed because they'd been up since 4 a.m. trying to make their accounts work. We're not normally people that like to do the same thing again and again in a systematic way. What we need to do, however, is we force ourselves, or our business rather, to go through that process. So it always strikes me that, as somebody said a while ago to me, that none of us talk to our accountants often enough normally, right? And one of the most successful businesses I know that's blown up and has doubled its revenue twice in the mastermind has a financial director at the center of that operations who is really, really savvy and comes from a much bigger corporate background. They managed to snag him and keep him. And that's one of the things, like, we don't talk to our accountants enough, and accountants tend to be objective and give us a lot of bad news we don't want to know. And this strikes me as a similar cleanup process. So in the end, if you can't look honestly and objectively at your business and it will stand up to that scrutiny, you are basically, you know, you're trying to paper over the cracks, and whether you own it or somebody else owns it, it's going to be a disaster, isn't it? So I'm 100% sold on this idea. And listen, I think this is a good place to sort of to leave this episode, because I think in the end, what you're just saying is a pretty simple message, which is like, here are some objective valuation metrics and sort of qualitative aspects of a business that a buyer would want. By the way, you really would have that. You really should have that as well as the owner right now, whether or not you sell it. And going through the process of prepping to sell is going to make your business better for everybody, whether it's you or another owner. So just get it done. So I think that very organically brings us to the call to action, the inevitable bit at the end of a podcast episode. So just, how do people get in touch with you if they want to get their business valued, or at least have a conversation about that process?
Well, yeah, and I would encourage everybody to do this process, right? It can be eye-opening. If it's with us or with anybody else, I would encourage you to do it. You can always reach out to us at quietlightbrokerage.com. You can email me directly, mark@quietlightbrokerage.com, to have a conversation about the business and understand could I sell it today? And if so, for how much? And what is really driving the value of my business? And what might be holding that value back? At Quiet Light, we're interested in the number of conversations that we have. We don't really look at it in terms of how many listings are we retaining on a monthly basis. We understand that will come on its own. I would rather give you the right information so that when that day does come, when the landscape of your life changes, if it comes, and for a lot of us it will, I want you to be prepared. I want you to be ready for that. I want you to be able to maximize the value of that exit, because it's a once-in-a-lifetime event for most of us. And for the rest of us that are lucky enough to do it a few times, it's a few times in our lifetime that we get to do it. So let's make the most of it. And it starts with having a conversation now. A lot of the advice that we give to people takes 3, 6, 12, 24 months, right, to implement. And so having that conversation now can really save you a lot of headaches down the road. So quietlightbrokerage.com, you can reach out to any of us. Every one of us is an entrepreneur, first and foremost. If you want to reach me directly, mark@quietlightbrokerage.com. Be happy to talk to any of your listeners.
Thank you. Now, fantastic. I was going to say reality check, but more than that, it's like a medical checkup, I guess. It's something that whilst you may have some initial bad news, if you've got yourself some time to fix it before you then have to do something about it, that's where the analogy breaks down. But anyway, you know, it's you know, get it ready as early as you can, get educated as early as you can. I just think I'm a huge believer in education by experts and in the end, you have to kind of get a team of experts in, but a broker so obviously seems like somebody you only reach to when you've got a business that you're going to be selling, but the truth messages is very different to that. So I would really just back up what you're saying, having spoken to several business brokers, knowing several business owners, some of whom want to hold for generations, some of whom want to sell in 3 years. I would really encourage anyone listening to reach out to a broker that you trust. Obviously, you've had a chance to check out Mark and his expertise and just have those conversations, whatever you plan to do next, because objective insight, if somebody's willing to give that to you, particularly for free, but even if you have to pay for it, it's so valuable. So Mark, thank you. That's really very helpful. I hope you know, if people take it this seriously, that you will have helped to save people from awful things happening to them 2 years down the line. So thank you very, very much for your help with that.
I appreciate you having me on the show. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the 10K Collective podcast. I really hope you found the show helpful. I mentioned the London-based masterminds we've been running since September 2017. Members of the 10K Collective Mastermind make a minimum of about £480,000 a year, well over €600,000 or dollars. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/10KC, K for kilo, C for Charlie. £1 million mastermind members make a minimum of £1.2 million a year. That's about $1.5 million US or euros. To find out more about that mastermind, go to amazingfba.com/MPM. That's M for mother, P for Peter, M for mother. Thanks for listening.